I've been on a low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. Hey everyone, welcome back to Project Mayday. These are your hosts, G and Bree, and today we have Cammy Graham. She is 33 years old. She is a physician at Rideout Hospital here in Northern California. And along with being a physician, she's also a medical director. And I know you cops out there and those military folk don't know what that means, so she will tell you all about that. And for the paramedics out there, you know exactly what that means, and you might get in trouble by her if you don't do the right thing. So without further ado, Cammy, welcome. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, you've been in emergency medicine for 8+ years, and what's unique about you is you started as an EMT, you know, and worked your way up to that. So give us that whole transition, you know, how you started at 18 as an EMT and then working your way up to where you are now.
Yeah, so I started with Kelseyville Fire at the age of 18. When I was very young, when I was 5, my sister had open heart surgery. And what probably I know now as a resident, I thought was this dreamy doctor that like taped her chest back together. And I was like, I want to do that. And in high school, one of our teachers worked for Kelseyville Fire. And so he was like, you should go and do the EMT class. And so I did that at 16. And then Kelseyville hired me as soon as I turned 18. And after that, I wanted nothing to do with like pediatric surgery and just wanted emergency medicine. So I worked for Kelseyville Fire and then worked in EMS is how I paid for college. And then I went on to medical school, and now I'm finally back in California, where I belong, out of the snow.
Great. And I'm so excited to have you on, because since you have that perspective of being a first responder and you're now a medical director for EMS week, we're really highlighting a lot of the things that we see, the kind of dichotomy between the two different fields. And you really are this magical unicorn hybrid that came out of EMS and now medical director.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts, is that I still get to be around my EMS family, but also do emergency medicine in-house. So I like the blend of the two.
Yeah. For EMS week, there's a lot of pre-hospital care that happens. And what happened is, in 1966, there was the white paper that came out. And this is like chapter 2 of the EMT book, right? Where it talks about, where did EMS even come to be? And so it talked about, you actually had a higher survival rate of being in the battlefield during wartime than being in a vehicle on the street of a civilian road in the United States. So in 1966, this paper was written. And now we're seeing this huge progression of EMS care. So in your perspective, can we kind of talk about the advantages of having a really efficient EMS system from your perspective of being the medical director?
So from our perspective, when you talk about emergency medicine, a lot of the big hot topic items, the things you have to do correctly, are STEMI, stroke, trauma, things like that. All of those completely depend on the care that EMS gives. And when you look at even our just hospital metrics alone, you see that the patients that come by EMS have better outcomes than the patients that walk through the front door, because their care is started in the field by someone who can recognize their symptoms and get them to the right place. And a lot of times that makes the decision of, do I go to the STEMI receiving center or do I go to the closest facility? But you can absolutely see that the care that EMS gives is crucial to patients having better outcomes. And that includes all of things, including out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. The survival to a good neurologic recovery is almost double in patients who have out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with EMS than patients who don't have any EMS care at all. So I think from our end, and what we're really finding in emergency medicine, and there's now an EMS fellowship for physicians that they can do, is that we have to incorporate the care that our folks in the pre-hospital setting are giving, so that we're including them on our quality improvements and on our turnaround times and things like that, because we know that they are the deciding factor on outcomes for a lot of these patients.
So, you know, like I said, you know, you started off as an EMT and worked your way up to where you are as a medical director. So what made you go that route instead of being a medic, like, you know, all of us that have done EMT and then went to medic and then that was it? So what was the driving force behind it?
I think for me, it was that I had a lot more questions honestly. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just know a little bit more about, like, why do we do this? When we have a STEMI patient, why do we do these things? Why does it matter? What's the background behind it? And I wanted to be able to do a lot more procedures too. I wanted to be able to kind of see care through. I obviously am not a family doc, so I'm not really interested in like seeing them again.
even though they're
classic ED doctor.
Right.
Well, even though you have those freaking flyers anyway, you so do. You're going to see.
Yeah, we've got some that are like family at this point, but I want to like be able to see patients, provide care. But then also from the hospital, what we can do, especially from a medical director side, is we can then do a lot more outreach too and reach a lot more of our vulnerable populations that can't get care. So I think just having the opportunity to do a little bit more. And I really like sleep, which as you all know, in the pre-hospital world is not really something you get.
That is correct. So can you explain to everyone what a medical director does specifically compared to an emergency room physician?
Yeah, so I'm still a practicing emergency room physician. I still do shifts every month and see patients, but I provide kind of the administrative oversight and the liaison with the rest of the hospital. So we develop the protocols for the hospital. I work very closely with our nursing director to involve them and our EMS director as well. But essentially the oversight of how the hospital and the ED runs, what our throughput is, what our metrics are, how we're giving care to patients, and then how we can coordinate with the rest of the hospital to make that happen, especially from the ED being the front door to the House of Medicine. It's more of kind of air traffic control and quality oversight.
You know, in that aspect, you're talking about protocols. You have a say in your county's protocols. So walk, you know, paramedics specifically that are listening, what's the process like? I know, you know, in the field, we're like, dang, I wish we had this, you know, right now. Like, why can't this be implemented right now? What goes behind that?
There's a lot. And I think a lot of our best ideas come from the medics in the field saying, hey, we wish we could do this. I think a lot of times what we do is take things that we find have really good outcomes in hospital. And then see, is there a way we can incorporate that into EMS so that patients are getting that care earlier? But then you have to balance that time, right? There's only so much that can be done in a transport, depending on if you're rural or local, that plays into it quite a bit. But is it really, is the benefit of that intervention worth a longer transport time? Do you want them on scene a little bit longer to get this in, or do you want them to just get to the hospital and then we can take it from there? So I think it's a gentle balance of what's new, what's innovative, what's really helping patient outcomes, and is that something that we can get in the pre-hospital setting without compromising the rest of their care and asking paramedics to do another thing in the 5 minutes that they have before they get to the hospital.
You know, yeah, you bring up a really good point. However, you know, me personally, I feel that the medical directors that I've worked under, they don't trust EMS like I want them to. Do you think that that's a general kind of feeling that EMS has in your county for yourself, or are you bridging the gap?
I think I'm trying to bridge the gap, definitely, because I think we don't give them enough credit. And I think for especially a lot of physicians, if they didn't do time in EMS themselves, actually time, not ride along necessarily, like sitting for 8 hours in an ambulance doesn't help you really understand what it's like to be caring for a patient by yourself back there. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, they look at the time of training and the protocols and say, oh, well, you know, I don't think they can handle that. And I think we don't give them enough credit for what they can. And we don't give them enough credit for the amazing work they're already doing and realize really how much they can do. And I really feel that if we share more of this information and bring them in as part of the collaboration in this, then we can really get a better sense of what would help you feel like you're giving better care. What do you think would help you in the field? Instead of us just making mandates. I think when I worked, like even for Kelseyville, I'd never met the medical director of the system ever. I don't even know what his name was at the time. But I knew there was all of a sudden a memo saying you've got to do this, but there was no reasoning why. There was no paper. Just send me the paper that you made this decision on, you know, they can read it and they can digest it, but including them in our journal clubs and in our educational opportunities at the hospital too, I think makes a huge difference and helps bridge that gap. But I definitely think it's a place that has a long way to go I think the EMS fellowship for emergency physicians is a huge part of that. So you now actually get EM boarded and you have a separate exam, but you do a significant amount of time out in the field actually running calls yourself. And I think that completely changes the perspective and is going to be part of the catalyst that helps bridge that gap.
Absolutely. And then a little sore subject is pediatric tubes. Y'all took it away from us.
In the state of California, let's just, because this is a national podcast, in the state of California, paramedics can no longer innovate pediatrics.
And that was, because right after that went into effect, I had one that I wanted the tube and I couldn't, you know, and that could have been the difference between life and death right there. So I think that's where the frustration comes from, for sure.
Yeah, and I think, so I actually rarely, if any, time intubate any of my codes anymore, even in the hospital, until you've got Ross back, because it really doesn't make a difference. I think in peds, the difficulty was their airways get so edematous, and so by the time they got to the hospital, if you're already on your second try, then you're in trouble with these patients. And so I think that was part of the catalyst to taking that away, was it wasn't used very often, and when it was, oftentimes it wasn't, it was causing issues down the line. And it also was very easy. We were seeing a lot of patients who had esophageal tubes, and it wasn't recognized because it's hard in a ped to recognize in the first place. But so then they were getting breath, but not actually getting any ventilation for their transport. And so I think there were a lot of things that played into that. I obviously wasn't in that discussion. That was from the California LEMSA. But I think those are a few of the things, was that kids are really, really easy to bag, and especially with the eye gels in place now that most, I think, systems have, that makes a huge difference. I honestly throw an eye gel in everything until I need a definitive airway, because they do a really good job and they're really easy. So I think that was our thought process, was we've got a great alternative. Let's try not to goof the kids and go from there.
Yeah,
I don't know if there was great data behind it, and I think it also very much depends on your when you trained as a medic.
Yes,
because if you had trained, you know, 10 or more years ago, you were intubating a lot more in the field and you were very comfortable. And it's similar to like a lot of the EM grads coming out of residency right now all use GlideScope and CMAX, whereas I can't use them. I can't use video. I am a direct, but it's because I learned decades ago. It's the same thing. They're actually very used to like using LMAs or even keys. And so they weren't intubating as often. And so they weren't as comfortable. So I think some of the bad outcomes from the change in practice style may have been part of that. But for like you and me, it's frustrating because we're like, no, like we got this.
Are you implying that I'm an older medic? Are you implying that I'm an older medic by saying you're
We are about the same age, so I assume. The fact that you're upset about it lets me know that you're an older medic.
Exactly. And I totally agree. I actually didn't really think about that on when you actually were trained. You know, I mean, I started paramedic school in 2009, and things have drastically changed in 12 years. Not only, I mean, we had to learn all the national scope drugs, but depending on what state you're working in, right, which ones do you use? Now you have new ones. And when I started as medic, we had Pitocin. For, you know, uterine hemorrhage, we could give Lasix in the field. And now all these things constantly change, which makes medicine always exciting and adaptive. But yeah, I definitely think some of our tricks and tips in the trade to really help patient outcomes, I think some people are offended and other people may be relieved that these things are removed.
Yeah, for some that weren't comfortable with it was, okay, I don't have to worry about intubating a kid anymore. And I've got other adjuncts I can use. But then for some of us that were really comfortable with it, it's like, man, you're taking away a tool, right? Especially if you've ever worked in rural EMS, it's a whole different ballgame. And I think that's part of the issue with these, like, mandates, right? Like, they took away my tube. But we need to do better of getting education out as to why. And what was the discussion behind it? So that then it's not just, oh, well, you're taking away one of my tools. If really there was really good data behind it, then let them know.
Yeah. And then, you know,
just
you're saying,
let them know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then you're saying, you know, take away tools. However, we've added tools as well as far as on the law enforcement side, you know, law enforcement carry Narcan now. And I mean, in your county, that's a problem, you know, as far as heroin goes and whatnot and other opioids. So, you know, what's kind of your feel about law enforcement being, do you think that they should be more trained in medically when they get hired, or, you know, what's your thinking behind that?
I think especially with stuff like Narcan, Narcan, BLS, often they are first to respond and get on scene. Most of the officers I interact with would love to have more tools that, you know, they could start before they get there. A lot of places, especially where I train in the Midwest, police and fire are both cross-trained to be able to do both, more so to help each other out in resource or poor areas. But in places like ours, we have a ton of Narcan that we actually give to all families that come in. The police officers have a lot of the field saves because they're often there first, or it happens in front of them as they're interacting with a subject. And so I think giving them tools that are safe and easy to use, I think they deserve that. They're there, they're interacting with the public, and it depends on the system. If you've got an ambulance on every corner, then maybe they don't need that and they don't want that responsibility. But simple things like Narcan, that you're not going to ever hurt anyone with it, rather than them sitting around like twiddling their fingers, I think it's completely reasonable to give them the option at least.
Yeah, so now let's transition into you specifically as far as your own mental health and, you know, your own mental health journey, because we're all in one, right? So, you know, you start off in the field, so you understand that whole stressor of being in the field and why there's such a high suicide rate amongst our, you know, us. And so what about you? You know, can you talk a little bit about your own mental health journey?
Yeah, I think I started in the age where you were told you don't cry, we don't talk about it. We just run calls when we come back, and then we like smoke a lot of cigars outside and we don't talk about it, right? And I think that's transitioned in EMS a little bit, as well as in emergency medicine. We have one of the highest suicide rates for physicians as well for similar reasons. You're seeing very sick patients with very little information, and you're trying to make good decisions. On the flip, and you have bad outcomes and you have bad patients, and you see kind of the worst parts of society. And it's hard. And so I think the biggest thing for me, has been just debriefing appropriately after bad calls and bad patients. And I actually call dispatch and bring the crews back to the hospital after, so that we can all debrief together and actually talk about it and be open and let everyone say open and honestly what they thought went well and what, like, we could have done better, and actually put it on the table while it's fresh and while it's raw, so that you're not packing that away and taking it home, because you've got to let it out at some point. And if you don't do it at the time, then it just builds, and eventually it's stacked in there somewhere, and you have substance use issues, you don't sleep, it just compounds, and for mental health reasons, it gets just not healthy. I think for me, that's the biggest part, is saying out loud, like, what my biases are about patients that really are difficult, that I personally have a hard time with, saying that out loud so that you make sure when you walk in that room, you're still giving the same care to the patient because you've voiced that, and recognized it, so that you don't have a bad outcome because of your own personal biases. I think that's been big for me. But in general, just having a great team around you, making time to actually block off time for rest and relaxation and leaving work. EMS is the same as emergency physicians. A lot of times we want to work as many shifts as we can, and we're the ones like in the middle of the night with a rock star, trying to just like muscle through.
I think we're finding right there. Yeah. Right? She literally has one right there.
And I think that era is changing for the better of people saying like, no, we're not going to work 19 shifts in a month. We're not going to do those kind of hours, and we are going to protect each other. I know our older docs think our younger docs are crazy because when they started, they did 25 shifts a month, and then they could have their giant house. Whereas my docs are like, I'd like to do 14, you know, and see my family. And so I think it's changing. And I think from the national level, from all of the EMS and pre-hospital organizations, as well as ASAP and EMRA and a lot of the emergency medicine associations, it's been a hot topic for a long time because we've seen such an increase in suicide and first responder death. And so I think talking about it and making active changes, but I think it also has to come from an organizational level and an administrative level, which is my job, making sure that people aren't doing things that could danger their mental health, that we're not putting brand new residents or medics into bad situations where they're going to have a bad case is going to affect the rest of their career. I think it has to come from your own personal space of what do I do to relax and reset? What do I enjoy doing outside of work? And what is a reasonable number of hours for me to work that I'm also kind of rejuvenating after that? But then I think there have to be several other levels of people watching out, because it's very easy to get in that rabbit hole and not see it yourself. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a director that says, hey, you're making some mistakes, or you look exhausted, or your interactions with your peers isn't the best, and I know that's not you. What do we need to do? And recognizing it for each other. And then just from a society, we all have to decide that together this isn't okay, and that we need to train better, we need to take care of each other better, and we need to make it okay to talk about mental health. And that you're having a hard time, and this whole muscle up and like just deal with it obviously isn't working.
Obviously.
And so instead we need to flip it and try something different. And it has nothing to do with like you being a bad provider to talk about a bad case that you had. We all are going to have them, and we should all be talking about them instead of like shouldering it and hoping you don't get a lawsuit or hoping you don't get fired. Mm-hmm. It's a whole environment change, I think, but it's important.
Yeah, Cammie, something that you said, I'm really glad you brought up. You said that you say out loud what your biases are for a patient before you even walk in the room. I think definitely we've talked to a lot of people on the podcast, and they do talk about calls that affected them. And I think a lot of it is, you know, you do reach this stage of burnout. It can happen. You hear the same address. You see the same person. There were patients, I could tell you every single medication, medical history, date of birth, and full name by heart. And I don't even have mm-hmm. to ask them anymore. So when we have these patients, I definitely think that there is this bias. But then that one time, right, that you may let your guard down and you have a bad outcome, sometimes that can also lead to your own, like you said, you're shouldering this burden of, you know, I didn't come into that space mentally prepared because of my own bias as a provider. And I'm sure, I mean, you do have your frequent flyers, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that. And I like what you said about how you kind of just acknowledge that you have this bias, whatever the population, whatever the patient is, to provide them what we took an oath to do, is to provide adequate medical care, because then you actually have nothing to hold on to after the call.
I think we all have those patients. We have them in the ED. I think the biggest part for me that I felt gives me a lot more joy in medicine is digging into some of these patients that you don't get the chance to when you're on a call, when you see them in the emergency department, you're trying to move the department. You don't get that chance to like dig into why are they so difficult, right? Why do they have substance use issues? Why are they constantly here? Because we get this beautiful opportunity. It's the same in EMS, is at any time, 24/7, 365, they have a place to turn, and we get the privilege to be those people. And I think thinking of it as a privilege that mm-hmm. we don't ever have to ask their insurance. We don't ever have to judge them for what decisions they've made. We just get to be there and provide really good care. And keeping that in mind, but then also on the back end, and it's a place where I try to, we're involving EMS a lot more in our street nursing and things like that we do it right out. But helping them dig into, on a protected time, why are these people the difficult patients? Is it that they are being abused at home? What led them down the path they are? And having a little better understanding, then when you go to their house, you get a little more background, you get it. And it makes it a little bit easier. But in the time, sometimes you need a reminder because they are difficult. They're mm-hmm. the ones that are screaming and cussing and demanding. And some of those patients are just hard to deal with, and it's hard to give compassionate care sometimes. But remembering that they're humans and that we are in a very privileged place to get to care for them. But then taking time and making sure that your organization is doing outreach so that you have more involvement with some of these patients where you can. Maybe it's a little fix that is the reason why they call every single day. It's mm-hmm. just something that they need that they don't have the ability to voice. And so I think that has helped. And we've tried to involve our EMS folks a little bit more so that then they can bring back that type of information and those experiences. Because it's not just about running calls and making your turnaround time. Mm-hmm. And I think having that part of medicine is really helpful to bring a different aspect. Otherwise, you're grinding. you know, and that's where burnout happens.
Mm-hmm. So this is EMS week. And I did want, since we were talking about assumptions, I wanted to just ask before we kind of wrap up, you're the medical director and you've definitely worked in the field. So what would you say is the most significant assumption that a physician or nurse in the emergency room has of EMS when they're bringing in a patient?
So I think it's very different. I think the docs are like, oh, well, you know, the ambulance drivers, right? Because they don't really know what you guys do all the time. So I think sometimes the docs get this, yeah, well, whatever, they brought it in. Mm-hmm. Whereas the nurses, I think, expect a lot more. And the nurse is like, well, why didn't you get this and this and this? And you're like, well, I had 5 minutes, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, chill out. And sometimes there's a mix, too. And, you know, I think the docs will often take, like, their knowledge of, like, a STEMI and weird presentations of a STEMI. And they often, at that point, have a lot more information. They can look at the EMR. They know more. It's like, well, how'd they miss this? It's like, well, because it doesn't meet criteria technically. And, you know, I think there's like, it's either one or the other is what I always felt like. It was, well, why didn't you do more? Or you did all this stuff and it's not even the correct thing. And I don't think they realize that in the field in a few minutes with very, even more limited information than what we have, you're trying to put a patient into a protocol, mm-hmm. right? And run the right list and make sure you get all the boxes checked of all of the things on top of the patient screaming and family's trying to get in the back of your rig and you're trying to load this 400-pound patient with the two of you. Like, there's a lot of other things that I don't get. I get pretty, like, mama bear in the ED, and I will snap at nurses and docs every once in a while when they start that, because I'm like, stop. stop or you're going to go spend a couple weeks out in the field, because...
You've got to, like you.
Right? And we have to, like, build a collaboration. Mm-hmm. I need the medic also to feel comfortable coming into the ER after a call and being like, will you look at this EKG? What do you think? Or would you have done anything differently? And I think it's really hard to be a Monday morning quarterback when you've never been in the back of a rig either. And so, you know, I tell them all the time, if you feel it in your heart of heart, call the stroke, call the STEMI, call the trauma. And then, like, let's talk about it later, and maybe they didn't quite meet the criteria, but always overcall, make sure you're doing the right thing, and just be confident. Mm-hmm. And then ask questions, ask, like, really good questions. And I want hospitals just to create a better environment where they're involved in our journal clubs and our, you know, our educational rounds and where we can, like, work together, because the only way our EMS system gets better is if we are involved and actively engaged in that. It's the same with, like, I don't know what's best in surgery right now. And we depend on our surgeons to really kind of work with us and help us learn more about, oh, well, now we're doing this bariatric surgery, we need to look for this. It's the same thing with our EMS counterparts. Mm-hmm. We need to involve them in the same education that we're doing.
Gotcha. So, you know, kind of wrapping it up here, what makes a good medic to you? When that person walks in through the door with a patient and he or she gives you the patient, gives you the rundown, what is it about that person, that medic, you're like, damn, that's a good medic?
I think it's part confidence to a point. I think it's cautious confidence of, this is what I saw, and this, I know my protocols, I know what I'm supposed to do, and I did all of those things, with a side of questioning and wanting debrief and asking more questions after. I think it's also just there's this, like, beautiful gem of medics that are really good at what they do, but they're also very empathetic and compassionate with their patients. And so they are the ones that it doesn't matter how crazy their patient is, everything comes in calm. And they give a good story and they're very concise. You can tell exactly how confident and how good they are at what they do with the ring down that they give when they get to the hospital, because they can give you a clear story in a great history, in just a few words. There's not a lot of rambling. But I think it's that, like, touch of the art of medicine too, of how do they interact with people and meet them where they are at their level. And then also apply medicine to what they need. Sometimes they don't need anything at all other than you getting them back into a good headspace. Mm-hmm. But I think there's always that gem. And I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of them, that it's just, you have to really enjoy what you're doing. That's why I always have kind of, like, hated this idea of if you want to be a firefighter at certain places, you've got to be a medic, right? Because the true medics that are great medics are there because they want to do medicine. Mm-hmm. Whereas you'll see at a lot of places, they are a medic because they like being a firefighter and they're a great firefighter. Mm-hmm. But they hate being in the back of that box. And so they aren't always the best. And it's not their fault. Necessarily.
She's talking to me right now.
I know. She's looking into your soul right now, G.
That's why I kind of hate that, like, combined, well, if you want to work for us, you got to be a medic. And I'm like, I completely understand from the fire side and working on that side of it, why that's really helpful, especially if you don't have private ambulance companies in your area. It's kind of a necessary evil. But you're also then not doing it for the right reasons. Which is also why I'm not a firefighter. I'm a crap firefighter. And that's why I went into medicine.
Now I'm a doctor.
But I think we should, you know.
Yeah. No, for
give
sure.
Give credit to those.
Absolutely. So now it's time for you to get on the hot seat. Okay. All right. So now the medical director's going to be asked some questions. The ones that, you know, when you pull that medic aside and you scare the living crud out of him or her, now we get to do it to you. So
you're so dramatic.
So the rules are, this is rapid fire. The rules are you answer in one word or one phrase, all right? Bree, take it over.
Okay. First question. If you had a warning label, what would yours say?
Stay 6 feet away.
Social distance.
Hey, Corona. Hey, COVID times.
It goes. It's been built. Okay. Second question. Who had the biggest impact on who you are today?
I think my dad, probably.
If you could have dinner with three people who are dead or alive, who would you pick?
Any at this point.
That's actually.
Even your frequent flyers?
If it was outside at a restaurant and I could have a beer, yeah. Most of my frequent flyers are great drinkers.
Oh, okay. What is your worst pet peeve about hospital staff?
Particularly nurses.
Oh, that's dangerous.
It is. G wanted me to add that in there.
So they're just like me.
Well, that's good.
Okay.
That was a safe answer.
That is definitely safe.
Okay. And last question. What is one word to describe yourself?
Grateful.
That's a good word. All right, Cammy, thank you so much for coming on, and definitely thank you for sharing this EMS week with us. You definitely have worn both hats as a first responder and now a medical director, and we're really grateful to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me, and happy EMS day to everyone. We promise to try and do something more than pizza for you this week.
It is appreciated.
Nice.
All right, this is Project Mayday. Call out.